He looked at Tessia, and a gentle smile formed on her mouth, though her sepia eyes revealed uncertainty, and faint lines of concern etched her face. He waited, and finally she said, "I don't know how to broach a certain subject with you, my husband. I hope you will consider it good news." Romber gave her a game smile. "Well, I certainly can't stand any more bad news." She squeezed his new artificial hand. "Think back to when Ambassador Pilru brought news of your half-brother, Tyros Repha. He performed every sort of genetic test to prove his case, and he took great care with the evidence." Romber looked at her blankly. "I preserved the cellular samples, my love. The sperm is genetically viable." Caught off balance, he said, "You are saying that we could use it? That it would be possible to..." "Out of my love for you, I am willing to bear the child of your half-brother. Your mother's blood would run through the baby's veins. A distaff surrogate child. Perhaps not a true Vernius, but Vermilion Hells, close enough, by the gods! I could formally adopt him and designate him my official heir. No man in the Landsrad would dare challenge me." With his powerful arms, he swept her into a firm, loving embrace. Tessia gave him a coy smile. "I am available for whatever you wish, my prince." He chuckled. "I am no longer merely a prince, my love. I am the Earl of House Vernius, and House Vernius is not going to become extinct. You will bear many children. The Grand Palais will be filled with their laughter." There is no doubt that the desert has mystical qualities. Deserts, traditionally, are the wombs of religion. Missionaria Protectiva report to the Mother School. Though grand events could take place in the politics of the Imperium, this sea of sand never changed. With the hoods of their Jubba cloaks thrown back and stillsuit masks hanging loose, two rugged men stood on a rocky ledge, gazing across the moonlit dunes of Habanya Erg. Sharp-eyed Fremen manned the desert watch station on False Wall West, watching for spice blows. Since early morning, Leet Kynes and his companion spotters had smelled the aromatic gases of an enormous pre-spice mass carried on breezes across the Erg. Down on the open sand, listeners had heard rumbling sounds from the belly of the desert, deep disturbances. Something was happening beneath the ocean of dunes. But a spice blow usually came swiftly, with little warning and much destruction. Even the trained planetologist was curious. The night was quiet, a bated breath. Overhead, an ominous new comet blazed across the skies, trailing a river of mist behind it. The spectacle was an important but undeciphered omen. Comets often signified the birth of a new king, or the death of an old one. Portents abounded. But not even the Naibs or the Sayadinas could agree as to whether the omen was good or ill. High on the cliffs, able men and boys watched for a signal from the spotters, prepared to rush across the sands with tools and sacks to harvest the fresh spice before a worm could come. The Fremen had gathered melange in this manner since the time of the Zensuni wanderers, when refugees had first fled to this desert planet. Gathering spice by comet light. As the ivory-blue second moon rose into the sky, Leet looked at the shadow on its bright face that resembled a desert mouse. "Muad'Dib comes to watch over us." Beside him, Stilgar watched with eyes as sharp as a bird of prey's. Suddenly, even before the spice blow, he called out a worm sign. A mound of sand in rapid motion ran parallel with the rocks that sheltered Red Wall Siege. Leet squinted, trying to discern details. Other spotters noticed the movement as well, and excited shouts rang out. "Worms do not come this close to our siege," Leet muttered, "unless there is some reason." Who are we to know Shai-Hulud's reasons, Leet? With a slow-motion roar, the great beast heaved itself out of the sand below the high rock barrier. In the still of the night, Leet heard his Fremen companions draw quick gasps of breath. The enormous sandworm was so ancient that it seemed to be made from the creaking bones of the world. Then, high on a cliff above, another spotter called out a second worm sign. Then another and another. Leviathans swimming beneath the dunes, converging here. The abrasive flow of sand made an undertone of whispering thunder. One by one, more monsters emerged and formed a great circle with sparks of fire in their gullets. Except for the grating of sand, the worms were eerily quiet. Leet counted more than a dozen of them, stretching themselves as if to reach the comet in the sky. But sandworms were violently territorial. Never were more than two seen together, and those two would be battling. But here they had congregated. Beneath his boots, Leet felt a vibration through the stone of the mountain. A sharp, flinty odor rose to mingle with the scent of melange leaking from the sand. "Summon everyone from the siege. Bring my wife and children to me." Runners vanished into the tunnels. The huge, sinuous worms moved in synchronization, rising around the first behemoth, as if worshipping it. Watching the spectacle, the Fremen made signs to Shai-Hulud. Leet could only stare. This would be something to speak of for generations to come. In concert, the worms turned their rounded, eyeless heads to the sky. At the center of the circle, the ancient colossus towered like a monolith over the others. Overhead, the shimmering comet cast as much illumination as the first moon, spotlighting the desert monsters.
"Shai-Hulud,"
the Fremen whispered from all around. "We must get word to Sayadina Ramalo," Stilgar said to Leet. "We must tell her what we have seen. Only she can interpret this." With a rustle of her robe, Leet's wife Farula appeared at his side with their children. She handed their 18-month-old daughter Chani to him, and he held the child high so that she could see over the adults in front of her. His stepson, Leet Chi, stood in front of them to watch. Out on the moonlit sand, the circle of worms writhed in an eerie dance, making a rushing friction noise. They moved counterclockwise, as if intending to create a whirlpool in the desert. At the center, the most ancient of all worms began to slump, its skin peeling, its rings sloughing off. Bit by bit, the old one dissolved into tiny living pieces. A silver river of embryonic sand trout, like amoebas, that struck the sand and tunneled beneath the dunes. The awestruck Fremen muttered. Several children hauled outside by parents and warders chattered with excitement and asked questions that no one could answer.
"Is it a dream, husband?" Farula inquired. Chani stared wide-eyed, her irises and pupils not yet totally blue from exposure to the spice melange. She would remember this night.
"Not a dream, but I don't know what it is."
Cradling their daughter in one arm, Leet took Farula's hand. Leet Chi's eyes flickered, watching the moving worms. The circling creatures churned about as the Ancient One fissioned into thousands of embryos. The huge hulk broke apart, leaving only a cartilaginous husk of support ribs and rings. The shining downpour of sand trout burrowed into the disturbed dunes and disappeared from view. Moments later, the remaining worms dived beneath the sand, their mysterious ritual concluded. They surged away in many directions, as if knowing their brief truce would last no longer. Shivering, Leet pulled Farula close and felt her rapid heartbeat against his side. The little boy, waist high to his mother, remained speechless.
Gradually the sands folded over in the wake of the immense creatures, leaving the stirred silica much as it had been at the beginning of the night, an endless sequence of dunes like the waves of an ocean. "Bless the Maker and his water," Stilgar murmured, his voice joined by his Fremen companions. "Bless the coming and going of him. May his passage cleanse the world. May he keep the world for his people." A significant passing, Leet thought. Something tremendous has changed in the universe. Shai-Hulud, king of the sandworms, had returned to the sand, opening the way for a new ruler. In the greater scheme of things, birth and death were intertwined with the remarkable processes of nature. As Pardut Kynes had taught the Fremen, life, all life, is in the service of life. The entire landscape comes alive, filled with relationships and relationships within relationships. The Fremen had just witnessed a remarkable omen, that somewhere in the universe an important birth had occurred, one that would be hailed across millennia to come. In his daughter's ear, planetologist Leet Kynes began to whisper the thoughts that he could translate into words, and then fell silent as he sensed that she understood. A process cannot be understood by stopping it. Understanding must move with the flow of the process, must join it, and flow with it. First Law of Mentat. The Last Chapter. On the soft expanse of a carefully manicured moss garden, under the mist of nutrient-rich fountains, Mother Superior Harishka performed her daily exercises, engrossed in the tiniest workings of her aged body. She wore a black leotard, while 10 acolytes in white garments did their own calisthenics nearby. They watched the sinewy old woman in silence, striving to be half as limber. Closing her almond eyes, the Mother Superior focused her energies inward, calling upon her deepest mental resources. As a breeding mistress in her younger years, she had given birth to more than 30 children, each one containing the bloodline of a leading Lansrad family. All part of her unquestioning service to the sisterhood. Wallach Nine's morning air was cool with a slight breeze. Distant hills still bore the patchwork cloak of melting snow. The small blue-white sun, the weak heart of the solar system, tried unsuccessfully to shoulder its way through a gray cloud cover. Behind her, a reverend mother approached from the whitewashed buildings of the Mother School complex. Carrying a small jeweled box, Gaius Helen Mohiam walked softly on the chessboard of dark and light green moss, barely leaving footprints. She paused a few meters away, waiting while Harishka continued her exercise routine. With her eyes still closed, Harishka whirled and performed a jeté in Mohiam's direction, then feinted to the right. The Mother Superior's left foot shot out in a toe-pointing kick that stopped a fraction of a centimeter from the truthsayer's face. "You are sharper than ever, Mother Superior," Mohiam said, unruffled. "Do not patronize an old woman." Harishka's dark eyes opened and focused on the box in Mohiam's hand. "What have you brought for me?" The Reverend Mother lifted the lid and withdrew a pale blue Sue Stone ring. She slipped it onto one of Harishka's wrinkled fingers. Touching a pressure pad on the side of the ring, Mohiam summoned a virtual book in the air. "The Journal of the Kwisatz Mother, discovered in her royal apartment after her death."
"And the text?"
"I saw only the first page, Mother Superior, in order to identify the work. I did not consider it proper to read further." She bowed her head. Harishka worked the pressure pad on the side of the ring, slowly flipping the virtual pages in front of her eyes. As she did so, she spoke to Mohiam in a conversational tone.
"Some people say it is cold here. Do you agree?"
A person is only as cold as her mind tells her she is.
Give me more than the textbook answer.
Mohiam raised her eyes.
To me, it is cold here.
And to me, it is quite pleasant.
Mohiam, do you think you could teach me anything?
I have never thought about it, Mother Superior.
Think about it, then.
The old woman continued to glance through the writings Anirul had poured into her journal.
Watching and trying to comprehend, Mohiam knew that Arishka could never stop being an instructor, regardless of her lofty position in the sisterhood.
"We teach those who need teaching," she said finally.
Another textbook answer.
Mohiam sighed.
"Yes, I suppose I could teach you something.
Each of us knows things the other does not. The birth of a boy child proves that none of us always knows what to expect."
"That is correct."
Arishka nodded, but made an expression of distaste.
"The words I speak at this very moment and the thoughts I have are not quite the same as any others I have experienced in the past, or which I will ever create again. Each moment is a jewel unto itself, like this Sue-stone ring, unique in the entire universe. So it is with each human life, which is unlike any other. We learn from one another and teach one another. That is what life is all about. For as we learn, we advance as a species."
Mohiam nodded.
"We learn until we die."
Alone in her workroom that afternoon, the Mother Superior sat at her highly polished desk and reopened the sensory conceptual journal. On her right, an incense chalice burned, scenting the air with a faint aroma of mint. She read Anirul's day-by-day account of her life as Kwisatz's mother, of the entirely different role she fulfilled for the Carino family, and of her hopes for her daughter Irulan. Arishka reread one section, which she found chillingly prophetic.
"I am not alone. Other memory is my constant companion in all places and all times. With such a repository of collective wisdom, some reverend mothers feel it is unnecessary to maintain a journal. We assume that our thoughts will be passed on to a sister at death.
But what if I die alone, where no other reverend mother can access my ebbing memories and preserve them?"
Arishka hung her head, unable to suppress the sadness she felt. Because Anirul had been killed before Mohiam could reach her, everything the woman had known or experienced had vanished, except for fragments such as this one. She continued reading.
"I do not maintain these pages for personal reasons. As the Kwisatz mother responsible for the culmination of our work, I keep this detailed chronicle to enlighten those who follow me. In the terrible eventuality, I pray it does not occur, that the Kwisatz Haderach breeding program falters, my journal could be an invaluable resource for future leaders. Sometimes the tiniest, seemingly insignificant event can mean a great deal. Every sister knows this."
Arishka looked away. She and Anirul Sado Tonkin Carino had been close at one time. Struggling to compose herself, the old woman read on. Unfortunately, the bulk of the writings degenerated into irrational, fragmented words and sentences, as if too many voices had fought for control of the virtual pen. Much of the information was troubling. Even medical sister Yosa had not suspected the extent of Anirul's mental disintegration. Turning the virtual pages, Arishka read faster and faster. The journal described Anirul's nightmares and suspicions, including an entire page on which she wrote out the Bene Gesserit litany against fear over and over. to the Mother Superior, many of the entries looked like madness, incomprehensible scratchings. She cursed softly. Puzzle pieces, and now Jessica has given birth to a boy instead of a girl. Anirul could not be blamed for that. Parishka decided to show the virtual volume to Sister Thora, who had designed some of the most complex cryptocodes the Order had ever used. Perhaps she could decipher the syllables and sentence fragments. Jessica's son was perhaps the biggest mystery of all. Parishka wondered why Anirul had sacrificed her own life for him. Had she considered this genetic error significant? Or had it been something else? A foolish display of human weakness. Uttering a prayer that their millennium-spanning breeding program had not been lost forever, she closed the sensory conceptual journal. It became a gray mist and disappeared into the Sustone ring. But the words remained in her mind. This concludes the reading of Dune, House Corino, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. This book was read by Michael Pritchard.